Week's broadcast of Radio Shalom was not aired due to a technical issue. This week we'll be replaying the program that was supposed to go to air. So here is the second part of an interview with Rabbi Brent on the topic of mysticism.
Shalom. This program is part two of a program on Jewish mysticism with Rabbi Brent from 2013. The interest in this subject is still there, so enjoy. Shalom, good morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you through Planet FM 104.6. Shalom, Rabbi Brent.
Shalom, Joan. Great to be here with you.
And thank you so much for your previous talk on mysticism, and now we're going a bit further in the journey.
Down the rabbit hole, right?
It is a bit like going down the rabbit hole. So we're talking about mysticism, now going back to the time of the Second Temple, which is about...
Well, the Second Temple, supposedly around around towards the end of the 6th century before the Common Era, the Edict of Cyrus was issued and the Jews were permitted to return and start building their temple once again after it was destroyed by the Babylonians. We don't really know because the temple was greatly expanded during a building project of King Herod, who ruled during Roman times. And the temple was likely completed with a huge renovation that included expanding the Temple Mount to what we know today, flattening the top of this mountain, putting a new structure on top that was meant to be rather imposing and magnificent in its appeal. That all probably finished around the year 30 of the Common Era. And then the Romans and the war with the Romans started around the year 68, and the temple was destroyed in the year 70. So this was a time of enormous tumult, but it's also a time that scholars have been able to make enormous light of through studying various manuscripts that circulated at this time, and also in being able to clarify for us what exactly this period was like, what was going on. I mean, if you imagine an entire people forcibly removed from their land and sent into exile. If you imagine these years of constant war where the Romans sought to put down rebellion in a fairly minor province known as Judea, where this stubborn group of people known as the Jews insisted that they would not adopt the Roman religion and would continue to worship their own religion. And we think about all the other things that happened there. This is also the era that was the birth time of Christianity, right? And Christ living and dying during the same exact period. And it's also the period where we find rabbinic Judaism, a new form of Judaism, different from the old priestly Judaism, that developed as a way of continuing Jewish tradition in a period where Jews no longer had a sovereign state of their own.
So was that the result of the Babylonian that the rabbinic started?
This is the result of the Romans. There are two temples, and the first one was built by King Solomon. Put an estimate on there. It's around the beginning of the first millennium before the Common Era. It was destroyed in the year 586. The Jews were taken into captivity. The Judeans were taken into captivity. The northern kingdom of Israel was destroyed earlier, by the way. And then they lived in captivity in Babylon until Cyrus, the king of the Persians, came and conquered Babylon and liberated the Jews and permitted them to go back and reestablish their homeland in Israel. And they rebuilt a temple, and that temple developed over time. It was renovated enormously by King Herod under Roman rule, completed around the year 30 of the Common Era, and then subsequently in a Jewish rebellion put down forcibly by the Romans, that temple was destroyed in the year 70 of the Common Era.
So they're really tumultuous times.
Extremely. The Roman tactics resembled others before them. I mean, we hear the Hanukkah story and how a pagan god was placed inside the temple and Jews were not allowed to circumcise anymore. And some of these are similar to that. The Romans forbid the teaching of Torah and the ordaining of new rabbis, of new rabbinic leaders of Judaism. And the rabbis were pursued as criminals. A number of them were martyred. And we think of Rabbi Akiva, who had tens of thousands of disciples taken into the stadium in Caesarea and flayed with iron combs. And then, of course, there's the figure of Shimon Bar Yochai. And Shimon Bar Yochai's story is that he was secretly teaching Torah and ordaining disciples, and he knew the Romans were out to get him. And so he went with his son, and he hid in a cave. And every day, they would bury themselves up to their necks and stay inside the cave so that they wouldn't be caught and captured. And then they'd come out and they'd eat carobs, and they did this for 70 days in this cave. And this figure, Shimon Bar Yochai, is the one we talked about last session that Moshe Dillon and his circle attributed the Zohar to. Because of the persecution faced by Jews, when people are being assaulted, the idea of looking for salvation anywhere you can find it, some sort of relief from this terrible situation you have, becomes very appealing. And so ideas about apocalypse, the end of an era, let's end this terrible era and have a new era. And often if we think about Revelations or other religious texts that talk about a new era, you know, Messiah, so to say, being born, it's after some great war, some battle of judgment, an Armageddon, right, on Armageddon. On the mountain of Megiddo, that's where the word Armageddon actually comes from. It's in Israel. It's a place located in the Jezreel Valley. You can still go there today and visit it and see stables built by kings and Egyptian ruins and things like that. It's a real place, Armageddon. And there's all sorts of people that may come up and claim to be the Messiah, that they're going to take us into this new era after the coming apocalypse. And some of these people might have traditions that rise up around them in Christianity. Or you know, they might be mystical and indicate that they've tapped into some new special truth or knowledge that was previously unknown. Or they might be the rabbis. And the rabbis came in and what they did was they codified and wrote down something they called the Oral Torah that they claimed had been passed to them from generation of leader to generation of leader all down the time, and they wrote this book called the Mishnah. Well, the Mishnah is an enormous work of Jewish law and lore. It later was developed by the next generation of rabbis who added Gemara to it, and it became the Talmud. Something we don't often realize about this major pillar of rabbinic Judaism, though, is that it rarely references the Bible in any significant way. Much of it is information that describes Jewish practices with no direct basis in the Bible. And yet these practices, because that's what had been done by the rabbis, were written down and passed down through time. So now we have a Passover Seder. And what do we discuss at the Passover Seder? We have the Magid, the story. And how's the Magid told? Well, traditionally, it's told through recounting these rabbis' discussions about the Exodus from Egypt. This is the sort of atmosphere that was abounding at the time that we can trace the earliest origins of Jewish mysticism. You had the Romans fighting a war, and what did that physically mean? When they came in, they killed and slaughtered. One out of every 10 Jews are estimated to have been killed in this revolt being put down by the Romans. We have the story of Masada and the zealots that held out there for years following the destruction of the temple. And then, of course, finally ended their struggle by having a collective suicide rather than being conquered and sent into slavery.
We still revere that.
It's complicated, though. Israel reveres it as part of its foundation ethos, but there's some elements in Israeli culture that seriously question if it's appropriate to revere a group of people that committed suicide. The Romans, in other senses, when they fought their campaigns, they wanted to leave no possibility that another rebellious group could take hold and plant themselves. And in particular, in the later revolt of 135 through 137 of the Common Era, they came and they salted the earth. They actually took salt and churned it and mixed it into the soil, because if you do that, it makes it very hard to grow crops.
To starve people.
Yeah. It was devastating, absolutely devastating. And so people were looking for hope wherever they could find it.
It hasn't changed much, has it?
Well, that's an irony of history. When you learn about it, you see all sorts of parallels to our Common Era. But the scope of what happened in the 20th century to the Jewish people outdoes even what happened in the Roman rebellions. One out of every three Jews was killed in the Holocaust. That is an astounding number. It's one that really, for us as Jews, gives us a serious and urgent message to answer about our faith. And that discussion continues to develop in all sorts of interesting ways contemporarily, but we're here to discuss the old origins of this.
Right? So in the same way, people are still looking for explanations and maybe something in the ether that we...
Mm.
So we go back to the Second Temple.
Right. Jewish mysticism probably has its roots even earlier than that. And probably, and we talked a little bit about how mysticism fills this basic human need to reconnect with a divine power entity that's become removed or distant from us, to close that gap from the time that evolved from the time when Adam walked with God and then, you know, to us who are living now that have no clear evidence that God hears anything that we're doing. Hence, the earliest forms of Jewish mysticism that we can trace are known as throne mysticism. Mysticism of God's throne, imagining God as a sovereign ruler and wanting to be able to glimpse God's throne. You know, what are the origins of these? There's actually some examples in the Bible. In the book of Exodus, at one point during the revelation on Sinai, Moses goes with a group of 70 elders and Aaron, and they climb the mountain, and we're told that they sit on a sapphire road. And there, they're at the foot of God, and God sitting there with them. God on God's throne, supposedly. These sort of discussions lent to questions of, well, what does God's throne look like? Having this experience of being in God's presence, this discussion of the Hebrew word cheshmal, which is some sort of atmospheric energy in the Bible. But today, cheshmal means electricity. Interesting how modern Hebrew returns these words to make them really useful and productive. One of the most important and really key texts to this development is something that happened in Ezekiel. And Ezekiel, if we think about it, Ezekiel is a prophet who wrote during the Babylonian exile. So right after the destruction of that first temple we talked about, we're not up to the period we're discussing quite yet. But Ezekiel would in certain ways give a context to what it meant to try to see God's throne that would solidify and codify into other areas. Can I share a piece of this with you? Just to give us a flavor of what this sort of thing is. This is reading from Ezekiel chapter 1, starting in verse 3. The word of God came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Kivar River. And the hand of God was there upon him. And I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came from the north, a great cloud, and a fire flaring up, and a brightness was around it. Out of its midst, as the color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. Also out of the midst came the likeness of four living creatures. And this was their appearance. They had a likeness of a man. And every one had four faces. And every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet. And the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot. And they sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. And they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. And the four had their faces and their wings. Thus their wings were joined one to another. They turned not when they went. They went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, the four had the face of a man and the face of a lion on the right side. And the four had the face of an ox on the left side. The four also had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. And their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. And they went, every one straight forward. There the spirit would go. They went, and they turned not when they went. For as for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of torches, it flashed up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright. And from the fire went forth lightning, and the living creatures ran and returned like the appearance of a flash of lightning. And as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with the four faces. The appearance of the wheels in their work was like the color of an emerald. And the four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel. When they moved from any of their four sides, and they did not turn when they moved. And their rims were like eyes. And it goes on and on and on with all of this detail. All of these descriptions of colors and
it sounds
animals.
Like he was smoking pot.
You wanted to discuss mysticism. You know, what is Ezekiel picturing? What is Ezekiel experiencing? It's God's throne. And what is God's throne at this point? Well, God's throne becomes a lot like a chariot. Hence, we have this idea of Merkava mysticism, chariot mysticism from the very early era of Jewish mysticism.
So those are the wheels?
Those are the wheels of the chariot. And God's on this chariot. And where does the idea that God's throne is a chariot come from? The book of Kings. When Elijah is at the end of his term and Elisha is taking over as the prophet of the northern state of the northern kingdom of Israel. A chariot appears in the heavens and comes down according to Elisha and picks up Elijah and rides off into the heavens. And so we have this idea that Elijah never really died. Elijah went on to be with God, and that Elijah will return to announce the coming of God's anointed one, the Messiah, to recreate, start anew a sovereign place of security and peace that will characterize the next epoch, where the Jews will no longer be hunted or no longer be troubled by outside powers, and where everyone will recognize the legitimacy of the Jewish God and where there'll be no more war. We're going to beat our swords into plowshares. I mean, this is really the end of one era and the bringing in of a divine new era. And it comes in the form of God bringing Elijah in a chariot, right? Returning in the chariot, God's throne.
Those images are quite frightening that you've just read.
Well, yes. This is powerful, powerful imagery. And we're talking about this lightning that's going through the sky again, Cheshmal, right? This energy in the atmosphere.
And this is what Ezekiel sees.
This is Ezekiel's experience. Of seeing, and so Merkavah mysticism was characterized by mystics who would sit and meditate and reach trances. And they would venture and try to understand and decode, well, you know, about Elijah's perception of God, Elijah's seeing of God. You know, is this accurate? What can we learn about being in God's presence that will bring us this immediate aspect of you know, having a direct experience of God? You know, what will close this gap and bring God more fully into our world as a real part? The Jews felt abandoned. They felt like God had utterly abandoned them. God would allow the temple to be destroyed.
His temple.
Her temple, whichever way you see it. And at the same time, there's this strain of Judaism that says that, no, God has not abandoned us. When the Jews go into exile, God comes with us. What we call the Shekhinah, God's emanating presence, follows us into exile. And we can have this experience of God, and we can find God through finding the throne. We can find through meditating that we're brought closer, through using chants and special magical alms and codes and keys, we can get there, but these are things that a master needs to be able to teach you.
So these are mantras and so on that mystics have taught their disciples, but many of them have come down.
Well, right. There's this, the Kabbalah again, which describes later mysticism means to receive. And so there's this chain of reception where these secrets are passed on and the process through which one does this became more clearly defined as well. As we get into later periods, this Merkavah chariot mysticism at getting at God's throne, the chariot, gains a new layer, and we have something called Hechalot mysticism, the mysticism of the divine halls of the heavenly court. And so, essentially, you want to learn how to move through each of these halls, each of these different places of consciousness.
So, like stages
of consciousness, places of consciousness, and a teacher can teach you the specific words you need to recite as the key or you know what you need to carry along with you in your journey to unlock the gate of every subsequent stage until finally moving through all of these chamber rooms, you can reach the throne room. You can reach the room where you can actually see and perceive and experience the presence of the chariot.
Does anybody ever arrive?
Curiously, the rabbinic sources record that there were rabbis that were involved in mysticism. As much as mysticism was shunned because there was the potential that you could go off and get high or do whatever and get a false idea about God. It was dangerous. The rabbis had an idea that you needed a minyan to pray with. You needed at least 10 because that ensured that no one was going off and doing anything funny, right?
And was that the origin?
Well, you know, the origin in terms of its argument is that these represent the 10 spies who needed to have faith so the Jews could enter, and they didn't have faith, and so we spent 40 years wandering in the desert instead of going in. But there's, I think, argument in you know, various scholars that would say that David Aaron, one of the primary factors, has written a whole work on an important piece of rabbinic literature opposing and arguing with mysticism, namely Bereshit Rabbah. That's the way he interprets the work Bereshit Rabbah, the great midrash on Genesis. But yeah, there's danger in these things, and you know you hear this language, and what ideas is someone going to get? You know, lunatics go out and pick up arms and are attacking people all of a sudden because they're going to get there, and I don't think the rabbis want that. Still, in rabbinic literature, we have certain rabbis that practiced, engaged in mysticism, and of those, Rabbi Akiva and three friends that he was with went into this place that we call the Pardes, or we're told is the Pardes, the orchard, and they ascended through the different levels at the Pardes, and of these, one died instantly, one went completely insane, a third one became a heretic, and only Rabbi Akiva managed to come out of the Pardes a whole person.
It sounds like a ritual by fire.
There's the idea of when these students study, yeah, if you study in the wrong way, you could burst into flame. Absolutely. And this danger is something that's understood and intuited by the rabbis. At the same time, there's literature that's massive on this subject, and you know follows these ideas developed through rabbinic texts about seven heavens being the seven hechalot literature. Like the idea of seven heavens actually comes from Jewish mysticism. That each of these hechals, each of these chamber rooms, each of these heavens has a guardian over it. That the guardian for the first layer is Metatron, given a name, and Metatron is the transfiguration of a character from Genesis known as Enoch. And we know and have some of these works that there's a whole set of apocrypha of extra biblical writings that were written in the biblical period but weren't accepted into the canon of the Bible, into what we consider the books of the Bible, known as the books of Enoch, that study this character who also, like Elijah, we're never told specifically that he dies. We're told that at the end of his life, he walked with God. And in these margins is where we find that there is actually a whole entire thread of Jewish mysticism that can be traced from this time all the way back to our early beginnings. This is what Gershom Scholem's life project was to do, to show this thread.
So in between the myths and the legends and the practices and the beliefs, it can lead to great confusion.
Yes, it can lead to great confusion. More than that, it can lead to very dangerous outcomes. But it can also lead to a remarkable, elevated experience of God, for those that are lucky enough to be successful in their mystical pursuits, and I'm not by any means claiming to be one of those people. But there are those that talk about going on machshavat derechs, on journeys of thought, and that through these journeys of thought, they're actually able to enter the world and realm of spirits in heaven and to discern from those experiences various events, potentially even future events that may unfold, and to bring protection in a way that opens up an avenue of communication with the divine that most of us feel completely foreign to in the modern world.
But I think everybody does have their own connection to their beliefs and to their conception of God, no matter what other people tell you.
They do. They do. And some people lack a belief in God as well.
So we will continue, Rabbi, the story of mysticism, because I'm quite interested in the thread. Mm-hmm. As I see it, it's a tapestry, and with this thread, if we can go back, and when are we going to leave the Second Temple?
We're going to leave the Second Temple and discuss how mysticism is shaped and transformed as it enters new regions on the Jewish landscape. And in particular, next time, we'll be visiting